Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our forum this afternoon on Ghana's preparations for oil production. And I think we have a very excellent panel this afternoon to give you a real-time glimpse into how Ghana is preparing for oil, what kinds of steps the government is making to prepare for oil, how civil society groups, parliamentarians, and others are organizing themselves to prepare for oil and to play a watchdog role in the future. My name is Ian Gary. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for Extractive Industries with Oxfam America, and have been working on the oil issues in Ghana for a number of years since oil was discovered in 2007. And I think there's a lot of interest in Ghana. This is a hotly debated topic, but as we've seen by the number of people who've RSVP'd for this program, quite a great deal of interest in this topic in Washington. And I think many people are very interested in what happens when you put the combination together of Ghana and oil. Ghana is obviously a country in West Africa that has seen notable improvements in governance, in fighting poverty over the last two decades. It's certainly seen as one of the stars, I would say, among donors. It wasn't a coincidence that President Obama chose Ghana as the first country that he visited after he assumed the presidency in the United States. So I think there are a lot of expectations both within Ghana regarding oil, but outside of Ghana regarding how the government will be able to manage its newfound oil wealth. A lot of questions on the table regarding, for example, how much money will come into Ghana, how much money should be saved, how much money should be spent, how the governance structures and the transparency issues should be dealt with and when it comes to revenue management, what types of information should be disclosed to the public for accountability purposes. So all of these questions are questions that we're going to be discussing today at this forum. Just a little bit of background on Oxfam America for those of you who might be new to our work in this area. Oxfam America has a global program on the impact of oil, gas, and mining operations in many parts of the world, including South America, West Africa, and Southeast Asia. We support civil society organizations, community-based organizations on the ground. We support efforts at the regional level. For example, we've been working with the economic community of West African states to facilitate civil society input into the development of a West African mining code. And in the U.S., we work in a campaigning mode, but also in a policy advocacy and research mode around two basic themes. One is the right to know, making sure that local populations and citizens have information about these projects, for example, environmental impact assessments, access to contracts and payments from companies to government, but also, importantly, the right to decide, that communities have a say on how and whether these projects go forward, and if so, under what conditions. I think Ghana is a living laboratory for all of these important issues. We've been supporting groups working on gold mining for many years in Ghana, and in the last several years been working on the oil issue. In 2009, we issued a report called Ghana's Big Test, Oil's Challenge to Democratic Development, and there are copies available outside. I think many of the issues raised in that report and the recommendations are still quite relevant a year on from the time that we launched that report in Accra. There certainly has been some signs of progress. For example, President Mills and the new NDC government in March last year stated that Ghana would be disclosing all present and future petroleum agreements. We haven't actually seen that disclosure, but the fact that the government started early on making statements about transparency has been important. In December, there was a cross-party communique signed by members of parliament from the major political parties in Ghana, including the National Democratic Congress, the New Patriotic Party, the Convention People's Party, and other parties, calling on the government to disclose these petroleum agreements, as well as for the government to stop issuing new petroleum licenses until the legal and regulatory framework is in place. And that's an important issue we'll be talking about today. I think most recently we were gratified to see that the Ministry of Finance has disclosed a draft proposal for management of petroleum revenues in Ghana, and that's something that we'll be discussing and something that civil society groups and others are inputting as we speak. So in terms of our format this afternoon, I've asked the ambassador to make some opening remarks, and then my colleague Mohamed Amin Adam from Publish What You Pay Ghana will be giving a PowerPoint presentation on some of the key issues. To introduce our panelists, on my left, His Excellency Ambassador Daniel Ohini Adjikum was appointed as ambassador to the United States in January 2009 by President Mills and has served in various diplomatic and political posts since 1971. He has served as Deputy Director of Middle East and Asia Division in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and for 6 years served as Ghana's High Commissioner to Canada. Ambassador Ohini Adjikum served as a substantive minister in the National Democratic Congress government during 1993 to 1998, served as a Greater Accra Regional Minister and Minister of Chieftaincy Affairs and State Protocol. The ambassador has a Bachelor of Arts honors degree in history from the University of Ghana and joined the Ghana Foreign Service in 1965. He has a postgraduate diploma in public administration from the Ghana Institute of Management and Public Administration and an international certificate in diplomacy from the Australian National University. On my right, Mohamed Amin Adam is an energy economist by profession and currently serves as the National Oil Coordinator of Publish What You Pay Ghana, a civil society coalition focused on promoting transparent and accountable management of oil and mineral wealth. Mr. Adam holds a BA in economics and a Master of Philosophy Economics from the University of Cape Coast, Ghana, and is also a PhD candidate in petroleum economics and policy at the University of Dundee. Mr. Adams was an energy policy analyst at the Ministry of Energy in Ghana and a former commissioner of the Public Utilities Regulatory Commission. He has considerable experience in public service, having served his country as a deputy minister of state and the mayor of Ghana's third city, Tamale. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to the ambassador.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for the very warm remarks about me. I must confess, I am not a specialist. I have no special knowledge about oil and the industry. So I think between Amin, who is a specialist, and I, we've agreed that I'll try to provide my sense of the policies that are in place to determine the way we have to go in exploiting the resources that by providence we have found in our seas. I'll try within the time allotted to me to indicate the general policy framework, providing an insight into all the attempts that we have made in order to be able to produce, distribute, and manage the oil resources. I think it is well known now that Ghana has found what I would call significant, not the huge amount that people are talking about, but significant amounts of oil resources in our part of the world. The recent discoveries have been made in the Jubilee oil fields, the Odum, Jata, and other fields within our waters. And we expect that the first production will start towards the end of this year. We're talking about between 120,000 barrels of oil per day, And as I was talking to my friend, we hope that these would last, all the fields would last for about, 35 years? It's a relatively very short time in the life of a country, certainly of human beings. A few decades ago, of course, to put in a historical context, we started looking for oil around the end of the 19th century, about 1896. But we only succeeded in finding some amount in about 15, 20 years ago. Today, of course, I think it's well known, we do have, and as I said, a significant amount of oil. It is our policy as a government, as a people, to ensure that from the experiences that we read and learn of other countries, as experts would say, that the oil that we have found does not become a curse. We want the resources in managing these resources to serve as a blessing for us. And so in inviting our partners, or when we partner institutions, corporate organizations, and multinationals in developing this oil industry, it is our expectation that we will do so in a spirit of transparency, mutual respect, to the benefit of all of us. We have, over the years, adopted a number of laws which are still being reviewed and being improved upon to deal with the new challenges that we are facing. But three laws were designed during the PNDC days, Law 64, 84, and then subsequently, I think it was 188. These were to provide a framework, a legal framework, for those who seek to engage us in the production management of our oil resources. During the past week, delegations from Ghana, in which I participated, have been talking to the World Bank on the way forward. And there's a general agreement, now that I'm here to represent Ghana in the U.S., that we should encourage, stimulate the interest of U.S. companies to go over to Ghana and help us develop our oil resources. As my good friend pointed out, we are fortunate that we have achieved a very large measure of political stability through good governance and the respect for the rule of law, so that we become a preferred, I think, within the sub-region, destination for investment. And as I speak to you today, I know of a number of U.S. companies who have either shown interest in helping us to develop the oil fields or are already participating in the production of oil. Recently, we have informed the World Bank and the IMF that we would like to have assistance in terms of obtaining information about institutions here which have the capacity to come and partner us to develop other fields than the Jubilee fields, because we have been able to identify a number of other fields which hold prospects of giving oil in good quantities. But as I said, in all this, we want to build a relationship that is that reflects the mutual interests of both partners, of both parties. As some of us keep on saying, we never knew oil was going to come to us. We have dependent for our time as independent country on gold, diamonds, manganese, bauxite, our forests. And so the oil that we have found has not been the essence or the basis of our living. For us, therefore, the greatest asset that we have, I believe it goes for all humanity, is the human being, is the people of Ghana. And that is why, as a policy, it is our determination to ensure that the interests of the people of Ghana are respected at all times. When the oil has come and gone, the interests of the people in terms of ensuring that you have a quality of life that is much better than we had or we have had so far, it is important in doing all these things that the environment which our forefathers left for us are not destroyed in the process because we want so much money from oil. We know about the experiences of other countries. We want to avoid those experiences. In other words, the communities in whose area we found the oil, their interests might be protected. I'm saying this because of, unfortunately, the controversy, what I call an irritant, that has emerged, arising in our relationship with a few, or just one, actually, company. And we've been trying to resolve this. The government and the Minister of Energy and the National Petroleum Corporation have decided that whatever it is, this issue must be resolved sooner rather than later. We are very much, as a policy, encouraged by the visit of President Obama, which we believe has opened doors and opportunities for Ghana to relate with as many investment groups as we can find here in the United States. We know the U.S. is a major partner when you talk about trade and investment, and we are very anxious that we develop this relationship on the strength of the visit that President Obama paid to Ghana. And that's why, as a policy, we do not intend that this irritating issue should become a major factor in our relationship. As I indicated, our main objective is to maximize and protect the interests of the people of Ghana in both oil and gas. And I repeat, that is our main interest. Money, of course, makes it a little easier for all of us to live. But for the new administration, money is not the beginning or the end of our lives. What I'd like to emphasize is while we engage the money companies that are willing to go to Ghana and invest, we would hope that as we move forward, our interests would be respected as much as we would respect the interests of the investors. Of course, we want to ensure that you do have good returns on your investment, no doubt about that. But it is also important that in doing so, our people begin to see the benefits, enjoy a higher than we have they enjoy today. A better quality of life in terms of education, in terms of health, and other infrastructural facilities. I would probably stop here. How much have I taken? Too long? And allow my good friend to present to you the specific areas that will be of interest to investors. If there are any gaps in terms of policy issues, I will again come back and attempt. But I was suggesting to my good friend that perhaps it's where we are going about this is to allow you to ask as many questions as would clarify some of the nagging issues while I'm here. And I'm sure he and his institute perhaps have some even better answers than I have. But together we can assist in answering or reacting to some of the concerns that some of you may have. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. So I'll ask my colleague, Mr. Adam, to present his presentation for about 25 minutes. And then we should have plenty of time, as the ambassador suggests, for a Q&A and discussion.
Thank you very much, Ian. And I'd also like to thank His Excellency the Ambassador for building a good foundation for me to stand on. The topic is, can Ghana beat the oil curse? Countdown to first oil. As was indicated earlier by His Excellency, this is not the first time Ghana found oil, but this is the first time Ghana found oil in commercial quantities. Production of oil is supposed to start in the last quarter of the year, and this is under a fast-track approach. Conventionally, in the industry, people take between 5 to 10 years to develop a field and produce, but Ghana is doing it under 3 years through a fast-track approach. Both the World Bank and the IMF predict that Ghana will earn about $1 billion in revenues as government shares every year for the next 20 years from the first phase of the Jubilee field. The Jubilee field is in phases. What is coming on stream is the first phase. And some people have argued that the reserve levels in Ghana is quite insignificant. And therefore, what we are also earning in terms of revenues is insignificant. But we say, why not? This is the more reason why we must make the right noises. Countries that have significant reserves and make significant revenues can afford the luxury of mistakes. But we cannot afford the luxury of mistakes. And so the right noises must be made now, to ensuring that the insignificant revenues that we're going to get from the industry is used well for the interest of the people. Secondly, Ghana's budget is largely funded by donor support. And considering the fact that in 2007, all the loans and the grants Ghana received amounted to some $1.3 billion, you know, you will see that $1 billion is significant in Ghana's economic terms, you know. This is why we are interested in how the revenues that accrue from the industry is used. But there are possibilities of the value increasing because there are some active licenses that are going on in the exploration of oil. About 12 of them are very active at the moment. And we've also recorded some recent successes. It is also important to note that the development of the Jubilee field was supported by the World Bank's IFC. And this demonstrates Ghana's good investment environment. The support was about $225 million. But where is Ghana's economy? We need to find the basis where Ghana is at the moment so we are able to know in future whether Ghana is beating the oil curse or not. In terms of economic performance, we have had mixed results. Inflation, for instance, fell from 44% in 2001 to 11% before 2008. And then between 2008 and early 2009, it went to 23%. And today, it is around 14%. So our results have been mixed in terms of the inflation figures. In terms of growth, we again moved from 3.7% in 2001 to 7.3% in 2008. And then we are back to 4.6%. So you will see in our history, the highest growth rate we've recorded was in 2008. But again, this was at a huge cost. We sacrificed stability. And therefore, we recorded a budget deficit of about 14% of GDP, which forced Ghana to look elsewhere for resources, including the IMF, from which Ghana withdrew some time ago. This is not the first time Ghana is going to manage resource revenues. We have experience in the management of mineral revenues. In 2008, for instance, revenues from the mining sector, overall revenue, stood at $2.3 billion. That is both company as well as government revenues. But what went to the government in real terms was around $200 million U.S. dollars. In spite of the insignificant receipts from the mining sector, the cost, social and environmental cost of mining has been so much, in fact, beyond the effect of the revenues that we received from that sector. A little statistics here. The mining sector contributes about 6.4% to GDP. But also, the social environmental cost of mining is about 4%. So in real terms, we are getting about 2.4% in the contribution of mining to GDP. Now, in terms of aid inflows, we have been able to manage aid inflows very well. Some people have argued that when you are receiving resource revenues, it may jeopardize your economy. If we make reference to aid inflows, the inflows haven't jeopardized our economy. But I must also confess that the inflows never went to the productive sectors of the economy. Ghana has largely used our inflows to build our international reserves, to strengthen the currency, and also to maintain a macro stability. Now, in view of the mixed results in the Ghanaian economy, some people have said that oil discovery is another window of opportunity for Ghana, and thus the question whether the oil is going to be a blessing or a curse, which I believe is the foundation for our meeting here today. But to be able to know what Ghana can do in terms of avoiding the curse, we must again know what the curse is. I am aware most of you in the audience are quite familiar with the curse, which manifests itself in the economy, in the environment, in the society, and also in governance. Sometimes people downplay the governance perspective. But for us as civil society, we are more interested in the governance perspective, because if governance is strengthened, if governance is deepened along the value chain, you know, in that industry, we will be able to check the other manifestations of the curse. But what causes the curse? So many factors, including poor public financial management, wrong spending decisions, institutional weaknesses, corruption, and non-transparency, to mention just a few. Now, in terms of Ghana's plan for oil and gas, His Excellency already mentioned some of the policies that exist in Ghana today. Government is developing new policies as well as new laws, you know, to create a more comprehensive policy and legal framework for the production of oil and gas. But as I said, this is not to say that we don't have existing legislations governing the petroleum sector. A number of laws are already in existence, except that we have some gaps in the existing laws. For instance, the value chain regulation is quite inadequate. Also, even though we have managed mineral revenues, petroleum revenue management is new to us. Government is also looking at what we call the local content and local participation policy. Our experience in the mining sector indicate that Ghana has not been successful in enforcing local content policies, and therefore that is also new to us as far as the petroleum sector is concerned. So new policies and legislations are being made to fill in the gaps in the existing policies and legislation. Yeah, in escaping the resource curse, there are key policy issues Ghana must be looking to. One of these is the value linkages. The conventional model has been to limit the linkages to trade, extraction maximization, value addition, and revenue management. But again, as civil society, we are concerned about governance. Any analysis of the value linkages without governance is incomplete. So it is important the governance perspective is looked at all levels of the value chain, from extraction level in terms of negotiating the petroleum agreements. I mean, this must be transparent and open. In terms of bidding for petroleum blocks, it must be open. In terms of conflict of interest, whether politicians will hide behind companies and take ownership of blocks. These are all issues we think must be looked at the extraction level. The value addition level, and that's where the local content comes in. Again, governance is important. Ghana doesn't have the capacity in terms of investors in Ghana, in terms of the business people participating effectively in the sector because of financial constraints, because of technical capacity constraints. And therefore, in supporting Ghanaian businesses to participate in the industry, we think that governance, again, is important. Business people who have political party cards must not necessarily be considered at the expense of those who are more qualified by merit. Then in revenue management, again, there are implications for transparency and accountability. And this is why we think that in analyzing the value chain or the value linkages in that sector, the governance perspective must not be lost sight of. Another key policy issue is revenue projections. The World Bank has projected at various price levels how much Ghana will get from the first phase of the Jubilee field. And this is how the trend looks like. Now, what you can see here is that irrespective of the price level, the peak revenues are around the same range. That is from 2013 to 2017. And as you go beyond that level, revenues, irrespective of the price levels, fall after the peak. So it is important as a country to recognize that oil revenues are depletable. Oil revenues will end one day. And therefore, we must make policies that have long-term effect so that when the resources are finally depleted, generations unborn could also benefit from the oil wealth of the country. Now, another key policy issue is the balance of interest. In every industry, there are interest, you know, groups, and particularly in the petroleum industry, the conventional model has been to look at the interest between the company and the government. You know, they share revenue or profit. While the company is concerned about profit maximization, government is concerned about its interest. You know, most people forget that the state may be different from the government. You know, in some jurisdictions, you have government concerned about how to maintain political power, how to maintain how to manage the resources for short-term benefits. But that of the state may have a different interest. The state may be looking for long-term, you know, benefits or long-term development. And so in looking at the interest within the sector, we mustn't limit it again to company and government. We must look at the overall interest of the state. Ghana has a problem of a long-term development plan. Every new party that comes into government comes with its own development plan. And if you are to use petroleum revenues sustainably, it must be done within the framework of a long-term development policy. And that is how society, that is how the state can benefit. We mustn't go far to look at what the long-term development vision of our country is. If we go to our constitution, the 1992 constitution, under the directive principle of state policy, it is quite clear on what the long-term vision of the country should be, except that the directive principles of state policies are non-enforceable in court. They are supposed to be guidelines. And so Ghana has an opportunity. We're reviewing our constitution to make amendment to certain sections of our constitution to introduce new ones. And this is an opportunity for us to ensure that the vision as clarified by the directive principle of state policy becomes enforceable so that every party that comes to power follow those guidelines in designing whatever development policy that the country needs. Yeah, another key policy issue is in the aspect of the revenue management. There are key questions that every country will ask when you want to use revenues from the extractive sector. And as a country, we must build consensus around the answers that we provide to these questions. Some of the questions are whether we are looking for short-term benefits or long-term benefits, whether we should spend on recurrent expenditure or capital expenditure, whether we should do current spending or intergenerational spending, whether we should do stabilization or growth or both. It is not by accident for some countries to emphasize stabilization at the expense of growth and for some to emphasize growth at the expense of stabilization. And whether both is also important is another question we have to answer. Then comes to issue of growth and redistribution. This defines the type of investment a country should make. For instance, if we look at the examples of Malaysia and Indonesia, Malaysia invested their resource revenues in industrialization, and therefore they recorded fast growth but slow redistribution. That of Indonesia invested in agriculture, and they recorded slow growth but fast redistribution. So it tells you that the type of investment that you make tells what you will achieve, whether you want growth or poverty reduction or both. How do we insulate our economy from the direct impact of oil revenues? We have been told about the Dutch disease over and over. For instance, if we don't insulate our economy from the direct impact of oil revenues, we're likely to have real currency appreciation, which may impact negatively on the agri sector in particular, in which Ghana has comparative advantage. Do we invest near our oil resources or away from the oil resources? In the western region where the oil is found, we have other natural resources such as gold, diamond, and others. Do we use the oil revenues to develop these natural resources, which are also found in that area, or we take it away from that area and invest elsewhere? Fortunately, we also have the two thermal electricity generating plants in the same region, the Abwasi thermal plant, then we also have the Efasu. Do we use the revenues to develop the gas, that we could use to generate more electricity for industries? Because Ghana has energy crisis most of the time. So these are questions we have to answer. And how do we address what we call the emerging resource nationalism in the Western region? The oil region, the people are calling for more allocations of the petroleum revenues, and they are quite emotional about that. This may give room to resource nationalism if it's not managed well. So these are the questions we need to answer. And I think in answering these questions as a nation, we need to build consensus around them, so that the objective of long-term national development is met. Yeah, on revenue management, again, the spending allocations. Government has indicated in the proposals that have been published that the country will make public investment, domestic investment, as well as investments abroad. And in terms of the domestic spending, the priority areas identified are social services, law and order, agriculture, energy, forestry management. But it is important to recognize that if you look at Ghana's budget today, a chunk of the budget goes to public consumption, recurrent expenditure. We don't do much investment. Investment in agriculture, for instance, as a percentage of total investment last year stood at less than 4%. So agriculture, which is so important, we don't invest. We use most of our budget resources for public consumption. Now, if we had to use petroleum revenues for public consumption instead of capital, as a development, then we must as well forget the oil. So I want to ask, for instance, if we are going to do domestic spending through budget support, how much of the budget support will go to public consumption? It's of interest to us as civil society in Ghana. Also, in the proposals published by the government for managing the revenues, oil-backed loans are supposed to be prohibited. The revenue management bill has not been passed yet. These are just proposals. And the proposals are called for prohibition of oil-backed loans. But what about spending on existing public debts? You know, the euro bond, which Ghana is indebted to, is due in 2017. When we are to service that bond, how are we going to service it? It's part of the petroleum revenues to be used to service that bond. We need to know. What about the domestic debts, which for a long time have crowded out the private sector? You know, the private sector, which is supposed to be the engine of growth in the country. So these are issues civil society organizations are asking and pressing for government to provide answers and also to provide direction so that these clear rules are defined before the petroleum revenues begin to flow. Government also indicated its preference for savings of some of the petroleum revenues. And two savings funds are being proposed, a stabilization fund and a heritage fund. Stabilization fund meant to smoothen expenditure during revenue shocks. But again, there is an issue here we must look at. Expenditure smoothing is a macroeconomic measure, you know, and countries often use it to fill in the gap in terms of revenues meant for spending. But these revenues are also usually spent on planned spending. But we also must recognize that shocks create structural changes, which may require reallocation of resources between sectors. And during that time, the question is, should we just use the stabilization fund to smoothen expenditure, or we need to reprioritize based on pro-growth sectors so that the cyclical problem and the structural problems are both solved? So we are not seen to be doing only stabilization. We are doing stabilization and growth at the same time. This is a model that has been advocated by some authors in the resource management economics. Now, in terms of the Heritage Fund, the essence of it is for intergenerational equity. But again, we must be able to solve a problem as to whether by intergenerational equity we mean sustainable budget support or sustainable impact of current spending. You know, after the oil resources are depleted, we will have the Heritage Fund. Are we then going to continue to use it for budget support? Or we should do the spending now in areas that have long-term benefits? This is another issue we're trying to resolve. There is a third issue of the permanent income hypothesis, whether we should not have a certain quantum of amount of a certain quantum of money every year that we put into the budget. But in determining the permanent income that we spend every year, it is important that the annual spending amount takes note of what we call estimated sustainable income, if we want to talk about sustainability of the use of the petroleum revenues. But in determining the estimated sustainable income, it also depends on the value you put on the petroleum wealth. The value you put on the petroleum wealth also depends on the size of the reserves. Unfortunately, for now, we do not know the true reserve levels. Different figures have come out. The GMPC has given figures different from the company, different from the World Bank and the IMF that have done some studies on Ghana's petroleum sector so far. The discount rate is also there. The future crude oil prices, how are we going to determine that? Most forecasts of prices tend to be unrealistic, you know. So it is important Ghana looks at these factors in determining the value that we put to the petroleum world. And that could give us a good foundation on the calculating the estimated sustainable income. Now, in terms of local content, which is another key issue, Ghana's proposal is to achieve a 90% Ghanaian participation by 2020. You know, most of us have questioned the rationale behind this. We see it to be too ambitious. You know, in terms of employment, goods and services, training, licensing, there is also the provision for local content development fund, and we have questioned how is this fund going to be managed. The proposals we have seen so far indicate that the local content development fund will be managed by the Minister of Energy and to be disbursed by the Minister of Energy. Civil society organizations are not in favor of this proposal. you know, because this may give room to our political patronage. But we must also recognize that local content is not free. There is a cost to local content, you know, and that is what we haven't looked at as a country. We have gone around the country talking about local content. Ghanaians are to be empowered to participate in the petroleum industry. But we don't explain to Ghanaians the cost associated with local participation. If we don't do that, we will rather build the expectations and it will blow on our face one day. Because when people are not seeing what they expect, you know, then there's mistrust, you know, which undermines the confidence they have in the government. And that could give room to the resource nationalism that we talked about. One of the costs of local content is that low standards may reduce petroleum revenues in future negotiations. You know, in-migration to oil communities may create social problems. We already have examples of people moving to the western region from other regions of the country, apparently to participate in the boom, you know. Yeah, but this also has serious social cost. In our mining areas, for instance, people have moved from the northern part of the country and other parts of the country to mining communities, and therefore prostitution is on the high. HIV AIDS infection is also very high in those mining communities. Are we to have the same experience in the oil communities just because people want to go and participate in the oil petroleum industry? The entire value chain should be considered. Then also zero export of crude eventually. People are calling for zero export of crude. That we should refine, you know, the oil, the crude in Ghana, rather than the use of FPSO, you know, where the oil is carried away. Ghanaians don't even see it. You know, if we want to give true meaning to local content and local participation, then Ghana must consider that. But there's a huge cost to this. How do we get the investors or investment resources to build the refineries? Now, conflict of interest and corruption in ownership. I think I talked about that earlier. There are some concerns about Ghana's preparation so far. One of it, I mentioned earlier, is the high expectations. There's also low level of understanding of the industry. Revenue proposals have what we call confidentiality clauses. And here again, we are worried about that as civil society. The reason we are worried is that the revenue proposals make provisions for some discretionary powers to the Minister of Finance. One discretionary power given to the Minister of Finance is that when excess revenues exceed one quarter of the annual funding, budget funding amount, but it's less than 5%, the minister has discretion either to transfer the money, the excess revenues, to the petroleum fund or to use it. This is one of the discretionary powers. Another discretionary power given to the minister is that we're supposed to have an investment advisory board, which is supposed to make investment decisions. But the minister is empowered that if the investment advisory board delays its advice within 15 days, I believe, the minister is empowered to take, you know, to make investment decisions. That's another discretionary power. Then in determining what goes to budget support, there is also some discretion there, because there are no clear rules. What the proposals merely mention is that it will be a predetermined percentage of benchmark revenue. And when you say predetermined percentage of benchmark revenue, without defining the assumptions, you know, and clear rules as to how that predetermined percentage is to be determined, there is also some room for discretion there. Now, our problem is not about the discretion per se, but where discretionary powers are given, they must be exercised transparently. But when you have discretionary powers and then you have confidentiality clauses at the same time, how do we marry the two? And this is why we are particularly concerned about the conditionality clauses in the proposals. Petroleum agreements, unitization agreement, and program of development have not been published. It's not in the public domain. So we don't even know cost per barrel of oil. And so you are not able to assess how much in real terms government shares will be. Now, one important thing which I'd like to mention is that the IFC, as I said earlier, financed the development of the Jubilee Field. And I believe they also have a stake in the FPSO. But in spite of the fact that IFC has its own guidelines in project finance, you know, pertaining to social and environmental impact, as well as disclosures, the IFC went ahead to approve a facility for Cosmos and Tolo, even though the environmental impact assessment at Ghana level were not concluded. You know, so these are some concerns that civil society organizations have as Ghana prepares for the production of oil. But why are CSOs particularly concerned about Ghana's oil production? One is expectations. This newspaper cut is somebody's article that is calling for the revenues to be used to service the debts by the debts of Volta River Authority, the Oil Refinery Electricity Company of Ghana. Some have also raised different expectations as to how the revenue should be used. Now, local content. This newspaper cut, Talo drops CityLink for foreign airline. CityLink is a Ghanaian airline, which Talo was using. But along the line, they dropped it for a foreign airline. So this raises the questions of standards. How are Ghanaians going to be supported to meet the international, so-called international standards so that Ghanaians can participate in the industry? Revenue transparency, confusion over oil revenue estimates. Different estimates have come up. The IMF, the World Bank, the government have all come up with different estimates. It is important we reconcile this estimate so that monitoring and then tracking can be done effectively. CSOs hail disclosure of petroleum bill. And here I want to show you a paper. Before the revenue proposals were published, government decided to conduct consultations around the country on how we manage revenues without publishing the proposals. We had questions on that because this is quite a technical area. And if you are providing leadership as a government, you ought to, you know, publish the proposals on the table, and then people will read the proposals and digest them before they attend the consultations so that they can make informed, you know, contributions. But this wasn't done, and so it took civil society organizations to organize a press conference calling for the disclosure of the proposals. I mean, this conference was read by myself. And that is one thing we want to commend the government on. Government was very positive in its response, you know, because following our press conference, the government published the proposals. And I hope the ambassador would take this message to the government that we in civil society appreciate, you know, the positive response government has given so far to the demands that we have made. And so when it was published, we again hailed the publication of the, to show to the government that we are not biased. We mean good for the country and we mean good for our people. EITI legislation, we also have had consensus, all stakeholders, government, civil society, private sector, to pass an EITI legislation, you know, so that we have more transparency in the payments and the receipts. We're also calling for strong parliamentary oversight. It is important we build our parliament, the parliamentary committees and parliament, so that they can back and bite. Currently, parliament can back, but they are not able to bite in the view of civil society. One example I'd like to give is the chairman of the Parliamentary Select Committee on Energy and Mines, Moses Asaga, who came out recently and complained that they, as committee members, have never seen a petroleum agreement. Yet it is the parliament that passes, that approves the agreement. This is clearly an issue we should be looking at. So if we have strong parliamentary oversight, I think that these issues can be dealt with. Human rights issues. Now, CSOs and the government, as I said, government has taken some positive steps, which we laud. One is the president's promise to publish all documents, which was done in February 2009. We consider this very positive because the previous government didn't do that. The only problem we have is that the promise hasn't been fulfilled 2 years on. And I'm sure His Excellency again will carry this to the attention of His Excellency the President. It is important this promise is fulfilled. Now, public consultations are ongoing on the policy and legal framework, which is initiated by government. So this is also very positive. Government has indicated publicly that it will extend the EITI to cover oil and gas and has gone beyond that to ask civil society organizations to nominate two people who will represent civil society on the National EITI Steering Committee. This is also very positive in our view. We also have had some CSO advocacy success. I'll just mention two. Before our press conference and the issues that we raised, we didn't have public oversight committee as part of the proposals for revenue management. But following that, the government introduced a public oversight committee, which will have representation from CSOs, from the traditional rulers, and other stakeholders. This is also, in our view, very positive. Now, some recommendations, the economy. I'll just read through them. Keep spending within limits. keep debts within levels that are not prohibitively expensive. Allocate and spend resources in those areas that make the greatest contribution to national development objectives. Allocate and spend resources in pro-growth sectors. Make efficient and effective use of resources. Use revenues for public investment rather than private consumption. Insulate economy from the effects of oil revenue. There can be issues of absorptive capacity, hence the need to invest in financial assets abroad. But this should be done with clear rules, clear investment rules, including the choice of fund managers if required. Now, for local content, these are some of the recommendations that we are making. Now, in terms of governance, the recommendations we're making are disclosures of contracts, agreements, payments, and receipts. We're calling for removal of confidentiality and stabilization clauses. Government has already put before Parliament the Freedom of Information Bill. We're calling on Parliament to look at it seriously and ensure that the bill becomes a law. We're calling for open bidding rounds for oil blocks. We're also calling for a moratorium on licensing until the legal and regulatory framework is put in place. And here, we indict our Parliament as well as government, because while we all concede that the country is developing new policy and legal framework, only last month, a new license was issued and approved by Parliament. I mean, we are not happy about this. We also calling for more transparency and that the legislation on EITI should be passed. International initiatives be intensified. And finally, the EITI compliance should be a condition for donor support to developing economies. Most people will be surprised why this is coming from a civil society organization, because we often criticize the conditionalities, you know, donors attach to facilities that they give to developing countries. But it is not all conditionalities that are bad. Some conditionalities, especially those that will enforce transparency and accountability, civil society is in support of that. And particularly for Ghana, government on its own, voluntarily, you know, in their program with the IMF, their current program with the IMF, indicated what government will do to promote transparency and accountability. And one of it is that the Freedom of Information Bill will be passed. Another is that government will hold consultations around the oil and gas sector to ensuring that the revenues that come out are managed well. These are commitments government itself made. So they are homegrown conditionalities. The IMF is holding government to that. We as civil society also want to hold government to its own commitment. And so, Excellency, when we are making so much noise, it is not because civil society wants to make noise. It's because government made commitments and we want government to fulfill those commitments. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, following the global financial crisis, debt levels are likely to increase, you know, across the world, you know, and Ghana is no exception. Hence the temptation to tie oil to loans. Civil society, we want to give notice that we will resist any attempt by government to tie oil to loans. Crude price volatility will continue to affect oil revenues. Hence the need to insulate the economy from oil revenues through economic diversification. And this is key, economic diversification, because that is what will ensure the long-term growth of the economy. Ghana's economy somehow is diversified. With oil coming on board, we should not, you know, take a departure from the model that we are following. With increased capital inflows from oil exports and with low absorptive capacity, donor development financing may be scaled down. You know, we have asked this question several times. We haven't gotten the right answers. Ghana has absorptive capacity problems. Oil revenues are coming in. Now, what is going to happen to donor support? Is it going to scale down? Is it going to be complete withdrawal? Is it going to go to build our international reserves? You know, these are options that we want to explore. The character of the current government towards transparency and accountability is very positive in the view of civil society. But future governments may not be the same. And this is why we're calling for legislating transparency initiatives so that whichever government comes is bound by, you know, those. The good intentions our current government has may not be the intentions of governments to come in future. So if we legislate these initiatives, they will have better effect. there are environmental, economic, and social costs of oil production, which should be addressed through special mitigation program. There is currently high expectations, and I talked about that, and in particular, the Western region, which may give rise to resource nationalism if we don't manage it well. If the petroleum resources will not be managed well, one demand civil society is making is that we should leave the oil. We shouldn't exploit the oil. You know, Ghana has come a long way in our democratic development. I believe one of the reasons why President Obama visited Ghana. But this is just conventional democracy, the one by Abraham Lincoln. Democracy, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But there's another side to democracy. If oil exploitation will increase poverty levels, if it will bring hunger, then that important aspect of democracy is being neglected. We want Ghana to succeed both in conventional democracy as well as in economic democracy. There was a political scientist in the U.S. here, Richie Calder, who defined democracy as a word that grumbles meaninglessly in empty stomachs. And this definition was adopted by a military dictator in Ghana called General Achampong, who said in one of his speeches, and I quote him, "The philosophy of one man, one vote is meaningless unless it is linked up with the philosophy of one man, one bread." End of quote. You know, but even this is even deepened by the International Commission of Jurists, who defined the rule of law redefined the rule of law in 1959. As a dynamic concept, which is employed not only to safeguard and advance civil liberties, conventional democracy, but also to provide social and economic conditions under which the legitimate aspirations of the people may be realized. On this note, I want to thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Adam. It was an excellent presentation. I wanted to invite the ambassador if he had any short response before we open it up to the audience. I know we have a number of Ghanaians and others who are probably quite interested in asking questions.
Other questions come.
Okay, great. Well, I'd like to take a round of questions. We do have a microphone, so if you could raise your hand and identify yourself when you ask the question.
My name is Kojo Arthur. I'm an associate professor at Marshall University. And I've followed the energy issues since 1982 when I published an article on Ghana's oil exploitation and exploration and cost me a job with the civil service in Ghana. And the ambassador, His Excellency, indicated that there is an irritant, but I don't think he elaborated on that irritant issue. And if this irritant issue, from what I think he was alluding to be the sale of Cosmos share in the oil project, is this being done by the Ghana government to increase its control of the oil, or is this just being done as part of enhancing the revenue? Because a key issue in the whole oil process is who gets to control the oil. And we can learn from the lessons of Canada, especially Newfoundland, Labrador area, that when the oil crisis happened, Canada found itself not controlling its oil, but U.S. companies were controlling. Is that what is the source of the irritancy, or what it is, please?
So if there are other questions, we'll take a couple more in this round.
Richard Downey from CSIS. The famous economist Paul Collier was in town a couple of months ago and giving a talk about oil revenue management, and He gave a particularly gloomy assessment of Ghana's ability to beat the oil curse, and one of his main points was that fiscal stability was being abandoned in favor of public consumption, and rather than an investment. So do you have any comments on that, and do you think his assessment was too gloomy?
But it's been abandoned in favor of
public consumption. I think there was another question here.
Yeah, I actually just had a clarification on Mr. Adams' first slide. You, in your background, you say that Ghana is going to get about $1 billion per year in revenue. And I was wondering what percentage you were actually estimating was going to go, what was going to be the government's share. Excuse me.
Anybody else?
Jamila Abdullahi with DevEx. I have a question on the issue of expectations. You both touched on the fact that that will probably be the tipping point on whether we are able to make use of the oil revenues or not. Although numbers are being published, I want to know how many public dialogues like this are taking place and how far government and civil society is going to explain these things to people, because even I'm sure some of us here, even though we're probably more conversant with these issues, we probably don't understand it as deeply as we should. So what are the initiatives in that area?
So I invite the ambassador to address those questions.
Some of which can be addressed by me, but a few others will have to go to our main presenter.
The question on irritants to you.
Let me start with the easier question first. Yeah. Expectations. I think my colleague over there and I would agree that there has been very extensive consultations between all the stakeholders, government, civil society, parliament, and others. This is continuing. Now, I like to remind ourselves that the oil industry is a very new field for us, very, very new indeed. And therefore, it will take some time as we address the challenges that we face, developing both the fiscal policy framework, the legislative framework. This is going to take some time. And if we have to be transparent, if we have to talk about good governance, obviously we've got to continue our discussions and our interactions with various sectors of the economy, of the society. So we do expect that at the end of it all, we will have a policy, a management system that will preempt are falling into the, do you call it Dutch disease? I'm not sure about, I'm a little bit worried about the word Dutch. But without offense to any Dutch sentiment, we do want to avoid that disease. If he probably would add a few words. Now, the government share of the $1 billion that is estimated, quite frankly, I'm not again sure whether there is any legislative framework which determines how much of it should go to government as yet. I believe that it's part of the ongoing review of the laws that we have. But I can tell you, I know there are several recommendations which have gone to government on the revenue distribution system. I believe that there's a review and an update of the petroleum taxation and revenue laws. Now, this has not been completed. So I don't think that we can't tell you how much of it will go to government. But I have been reading, and I served there for a while, in Scandinavia. And some of us are very excited about the Norwegian experience. I'm sure some of you have read about the Norwegian experience, where they have a pension fund which takes care of the generation's interest. If we have to sustain our development programs, as economy define it, we must be able to address our own concerns today without jeopardizing the interest of the future. So I've read about the Norwegian experience, and I'm trying to get our government to look at it and see which aspects of that experience can be of benefit to us. As I said, this is an entirely new field for us. And the other question was about abandoning fiscal stability in preference, did you say, to public consumption. As I said, we've been talking to the IMF and the World Bank, and we are discussing what the options are. Now, obviously, you cannot starve a people. Why we talk about fiscal stability, closing the deficit and all that. If you know, you have any idea about the Western region, this is a very deprived area, especially along the coastal belt. But this is an area where we have been mining gold and other minerals for a very long time. Another aspect of this question, somebody was talking about the Western region. Now, we in Ashanti, those of us from Ashanti, have been financing developments from the cocoa resources for years. Now, if the Western regional communities are lucky to have oil, we expect that it will be distributed equitably for all other parts of the country to enjoy the benefits. But it's important that because it's a deprived region, we must perhaps make a special allocation. But this, I believe, whatever policy emerges will come out of the discussions we are holding as we speak today. So fiscal stability is important. It is absolutely important for us in terms of our development programs. But we're not going to abandon that and consume all that we need to consume within a short period of time. So my good friend talked about savings. Well, for me, the Norwegian model is very relevant to our own situation. And as I said, I'm trying to recommend this to our government. We will have to satisfy the current demands, the current needs of our people, but we need to save. In order to save, we have to achieve a large measure of macroeconomic stability and fiscal stability. I'm sure Dr. Amin, almost a doctor, will have something to add to that.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
I must, just one more. I must be honest with the gentleman. Professor from, is it Howard? Marshall. I am a little hesitant to talk about this publicly. It's not, I think we agreed, both parties. I was a member of the delegation that met the COSMOS recently. We agreed that this is not an issue we should engage our attention in, so to speak, in the media warfare. Because after all the allegations, claims, accusations, there have been counter all these things, counter claims, counter allegations, counter accusations, and so on. And for some of us, speaking as a diplomat, I don't think that we need to go that way. We should give diplomacy a chance. We are talking to Cosmos. And we've had discussions with ExxonMobil. And I want to believe that, given the chance, we should be able to overcome. It's not a problem. It's not an issue as such. It's very irritating on both parties for us not to be able to resolve the problem sooner rather than later. But we are determined on our part to have it resolved. I can assure you that the president has been talking a great deal about the need, the necessity for both parties to sit down and find a way to resolving the problem. That's all I can say for now.
Mr. Adam.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, in terms of the fiscal stability, I think that Ghana for the past decade has had a fixation for fiscal stability, except the election year that fiscal stability was abandoned. You know, we indeed sacrificed the fiscal stability, even though we ended up with the highest growth rate in the country. Public consumption will continue to be a large chunk of the government budget because salaries alone is more than 50% of government revenues every year, you know. And the public sector is fraught with inefficiencies, it's overbloated, so many ghost names. Just last week, the government announced that they have found 2,000 ghost names. And by ghost names, you know, people whose names are on the payroll, and yet they don't exist, you know, where that money goes. You know, so public consumption is affected by all those factors. But the growth that we recorded in the election year actually came from the services sector, telecommunication, and the Vodafone deal in particular. Was a significant factor. Then also in construction, we did a lot of road constructions. You know, that was how come the growth went higher. But this could have been due to the fact that the party in government then wanted to retain power and therefore abandon fiscal stability. But the new government is has taken fiscal stability very high. And this is why I believe the World Bank and the IMF are happy working in Ghana, again, to ensure that stability is maintained. And we've had some successes because the currency is now stabilized, even though it was skyrocketing in terms of depreciation. Other macroeconomic indicators have become stabilized. Now, regarding the government revenues, what I said was that the $1 billion is what is going to the government through a combination of royalty that is due the government and taxes. The corporate tax is about 35%. You know, that is quite huge. So if you add that to the royalties that is coming to the government, will be getting about $1 billion. And this by projections, these projections by the World Bank and the IMF. So this is not for the total revenue. This is what to go to the government. Then expectations. We have been doing a lot to manage the expectations. Government, as I said in my presentation, has already completed discussions, consultations around the country on the revenue management proposals. They are currently doing another consultation, round of consultations on the local content and local participation. We have engaged Parliament that when the bills finally arrive, before Parliament, Parliament should open for another round of consultation. And Parliament has agreed to our proposals. We also, as civil society organizations, have done parallel consultations. You know, we had a meeting with the government to do common consultation so that we will go ahead as civil society to educate the people on the main issues. And then government will then come with its forum so that people go to the government forum already well aware of the issues. But this was abandoned along the line. The government said they want to do theirs, we will do ours, so that at some point we'll converge. You know. So we have done some consultations as civil society around the country. The problem we had with the government consultation was that an announcement is made, people are invited, and they go and participate without regards to what we call stakeholder identification. you know, we think that stakeholder mapping is very important in such consultations because the public can come in, but identifiable stakeholders who have issues to raise may not be there. So it is important while you announce for the public to come and participate, you also go further to do stakeholder mapping and ensure that identifiable groups, people who have real social and environmental issues, participate in the forum. That is what civil society is doing. So we are complementing what the government is doing. And around the 8th or 9th of June, there will be a stakeholder conference, a multi-stakeholder conference between the government, our side, the private sector, you know, to fine-tune the concerns that have come from across the country. Because most of the time, government will have its own document before going around to do the consultations. And then the final document that comes out may not even reflect the concerns that come from the consultations. So this time, we are making sure that the views that are expressed by people reflect in the final document that comes out. That is why we're calling for a multi-stakeholder conference to look at what views were expressed in every region of the country. And we will have a document that we can use to monitor, to assess whether the final bill that will go to Parliament reflects the concerns of people. But we still have a lot to do in terms of the management of the expectations. I think I've touched all this.
So we'll take a second round of questions.
Hi, I'm Paul Bagawa, Calvert Investments. I wonder, I guess this would be a difficult question for His Excellency to answer, so maybe Mr. Adam could address. Have the companies operating in the Jubilee field and other fields expressed any concern of the level of disclosure that civil society is calling for here, and could that be part of the reason why President Mills hasn't been able to follow through on his promise of February 2009?
Come again, I'm not quite sure I...
I'm wondering if there's company opposition to the level of disclosure that civil society is calling for, and if that's part of the problem with you know, being able to follow through on some of these commitments.
So you mean in relation to disclosure of contracts and
Correct.
Other issues?
Right.
Okay. Other questions? Now it's warming up.
My name is Deirdre LePin. I work as a consultant in the area of corporate responsibility, and I've also worked inside an oil company in the Niger Delta, and I've also worked in IFC on the social development and environmental standards, the performance standards. So I've seen this from many points of view, but I'm fundamentally a community advocate. And so I see a very delicate balancing act developing between the ambassador's position that the communities should share their oil wealth with the rest of the country, and the fact that there are impacts which we know about historically, which occur in oil and gas producing areas, as they do in mining and other extractive, which sometimes can be predicted, but not always anticipated, but which can have very negative effects on the lives of people. I mean, they range from inflation to influx of personnel to displacement of local economy, all of these things. Now, is there a genuine effort to pay attention to these impacts? Because treating these is not like a vaccine for measles or polio. It's more like a prophylaxis against malaria. It has to be worked at over and over and over again every single day with a great deal of targeted effort. So I'm wondering to what extent civil society is addressing this, companies are addressing this, and the government is addressing this.
My name is Gloria Fribwedu. I'm a lawyer and also president of the Women Assistance and Business Association in Ghana. I'm just thinking about the local content. I haven't studied it. I'm just wondering, is there any place for training, you know, where the companies like Tulu and others can train local personnel? Because I think there's a lack of that as compared to Nigeria, who have quite a high, you know, rate of personnel trained in oil and gas industry since they've been there for about 40 years. Is there something like that? You know, maybe I recommend that it's gender sensitive.
Lauren Young, I'm with the Center for Global Development. I'm curious in your assessment of the mechanisms that are put in place in the proposal for a stabilization heritage fund. Do you think they're strong enough to prevent, you know, future government or this government from raiding the fund? And do they change the fundamental balance of power between the government and citizens?
Question about the So we'll start with that round, and I'm sure we'll have time for another round. So there was a question around company positions regarding disclosure of contracts and other information, whether that has been any impediment to the government following through on its declared intention to disclose petroleum agreements. A second question on attention to social and environmental impacts and what companies, civil society groups, and government have been doing in that area. A question regarding local content, whether there's training being done by the companies or others, and then finally, the mechanisms for the Stabilization Heritage Fund, whether there are safeguards, whether the safeguards being proposed you believe are strong enough to prevent raiding of these funds in the future. Should we switch? Mr. Adam, would you like to go first?
Oh, but I thought you've been
working on this.
Yeah. So just let us know what you have.
Well, I think that some of the companies have shown commitment to disclosing information, but the current agreements that are signed between the agreements signed between them and government have provisions for confidentiality clauses as well as stabilization clauses. What is currently happening between the government of Ghana and Cosmos in terms of Cosmos giving out some information to Exim, for which reason government has raised concerns of violation of the agreement, I believe is the reason why most of the information so far have not been published, because this is an issue companies should have been raising. You know, why do you disclose information from our agreement? But if it is the government that is rather raising issues, why Cosmos will give out some information contrary to the provisions of the agreement, then there is clearly a problem on the part of the government. I mean, Exim may be a company. It's not a public entity. I don't know the ownership of Exim, but if part of the one of the companies in the agreement can give out information, part of the information may find its way to the public, to the citizens, and I think that the government's position on why such information should be given out, contrary to the provisions of the agreement. It's quite monumental in the area of transparency. You know, I am wondering how government can come out again to say that information must be disclosed when it is the same government that is chastising one of the companies for giving out information. So I have spoken to most of the companies, Tullo, Cosmos, and they've all indicated to me that they are ready to give out information. I mean, the fact that they accepted financing facility from IFC also demonstrates their commitment to give out information, because by the IFC financing, they are obliged, you know, they are mandated. It's part of the conditions for the financing, you know. So that is what I can say about that.
If I could just add on that, the Tullo position was stated in a conference that Oxfam and a number of other organizations organized last September, an international conference on extractive industry contracts. And this question was put to the representative, the vice president for external affairs, who said, both in the case of Ghana and Uganda, that if the government did not have a problem with disclosure, that they would be happy to disclose the petroleum agreement. So it would seem, at least on the case of Tullo, that we have a case where the government, from the president and vice president down, have said that the contracts could be disclosed and that one of the major operators has said that they don't have a problem with that. So it's an interesting question, and we'd like to see the government follow through on the disclosure promise.
Yeah, in the area of specific effects of oil as exploitation in oil communities, I agree with you, madam, and we have called for some mitigation programs. If you look at my conclusion, I believe the point, but last, okay. I indicated here in my conclusion that there are social and environmental costs of oil extraction. And this, yeah, there are environmental, economic, and social costs of oil production, which should be addressed through special mitigation programs. And indeed, the revenue proposals published by the government recognized that and made provisions for special financing programs to address certain social and environmental impacts of oil extraction, except that they also added a clause that this will not be permanent. You know, I believe the non-permanency of such interventions is to address issues of expectations, you know, so that people from in other parts of the country that are also producing other forms of minerals do not also begin to call for that. Otherwise, if every special group is to call for special mitigation programs, then we may not be able to use the revenues for real investment. So government recognizes that, and we will continue to put pressure on government as and when those issues come up. Civil society has created groups within the oil communities. We call them we have some advocacy groups that are rapid response teams that we have gotten in all the oil communities, which we are training so that they'll be able to monitor environmental impact, social impact, economic impact, and report to us. It is important I mentioned to you that civil societies in Ghana have come together to form a platform, you know, to be able to effectively engage other stakeholders, to strengthen our position, to create that common forum for us to express our concerns. It is this platform that has identified some other CSO groups in the oil communities who are being trained, you know, to be able to monitor and report to us. As and when there is an oil spillage, they will report to us, and we will move out and do the advocacy so that the appropriate responses are given. You know, so through that, we'll be able to inform government and other stakeholders what we think should be doing as mitigating measures to solve the specific problems that may accompany oil production. Now, training of local personnel and the local content, there are plans for that. The companies have also committed to contributing money to the local content development fund, which government will be establishing. They are also doing their own training. I mean, I do not want to be speaking for the government or for the companies because of my background, but the reality is that Tullo has already sent some Ghanaians abroad who are being trained to come and work in the company. Government has also come out with a comprehensive program that will be used to train artisans, mostly from the oil communities, to be able to work in there. But the reality is that the FPSO can take only 200 people. So if 200 people are to be employed on the FPSO, who are we training then? We may train them because there are other service providers, you know, around the oil field, you know. But in the long run, only a few people will be employed in that sector. And this is why most of us are emphasizing diversification, economic diversification. You know, the people who are doing fishing in that area, who will be denied of their livelihood as a result of oil production. I mean, livelihood disruptions must be looked at. Government must fund alternative livelihood, you know, programs for those people so that they necessarily do not ask for employment in the oil sector. You know, and some of them have told us, when we did our consultation in Takoradi, that they don't want to work on the FPSO. They rather want what they call livelihood diversification, to quote them, livelihood diversification. The government should try to support them to do other things that they know best, you know, rather than always saying that we want you to work in the oil communities. You know, so these are some of the concerns that have come from the community. But to tell you the truth, there is a program. There is even an institute to be established in Takoradi for purposes of training those who want to work in the oil sector. Now, mechanism for stabilization and heritage funds. How do we ensure that the money is not rigged? So far, the proposals have been far-reaching. They are quite strong proposals, except a few that we have concerns about. One of the problems we have is about the heritage fund. The proposal is to spend 20%, or not more than 20%, in the domestic, I mean strategic domestic areas on commercial basis. And the 20% that will be spent, we need to know how it is going to be disbursed. We don't want to promote cronyism, because it is possible, you know, this 20% will be given to party people or party business people rather than given to genuine Ghanaians who qualify by merit. That is one concern that we have. The second concern we have is what I said earlier, the discretion given to the minister in terms of transferring extra revenues to the fund. You know, this clearly is an issue on how money goes into the fund. If it's the minister who decides whether to transfer the money to the fund or not, then this could be abused as well. So we have a problem with that as well. So there are a few concerns that we have in terms of the mechanisms for ensuring that the stabilization and the heritage fund. The third one I was going to forget, which is also very important, is that the proposals indicate that the money that will be taken or drawn from the heritage fund in particular should not exceed the estimated sustainable income. But also went to say that, however, under some conditions, the minister may exceed it, but only needs to explain to Parliament why it is exceeding it. We have a problem with that as well, because all the explanations can be given to Parliament. And in a case where the party in government has majority in Parliament, they will go and do yeah to whatever explanations that will be given by the minister. So these are some of the issues we have, which we think must be looked at again.
Okay. Maybe I should start from the last one first. What you just talked about. I think when you put all these things together, what my sense is that all these proposals and suggestions are at the very initial stages. And that's why there's a need, that's why we've been consulting with civil society and other institutions. Nothing is determined yet. Whatever laws or policies that emerge out of these discussions, of course, will be discussed further by civil society, by Parliament, so that we come up with, if it's a policy that would address, by and large, all the concerns of the communities. It is interesting that when you talk about oil for knowing what happened in other places, the Niger Delta, we talked about hunger and feeding and all that. But there's another aspect. Violence that could possibly erupt as a consequence of the community having a feeling that they have been denied access to what they perceive as a legitimate resource. But at the same time, for us in Ghana, for all these years, Ashanti was known to be the gold. The Gold Coast, it was from Ashanti, not from any other part of the country, until other parts, Tarkwa also discovered gold. But for all these years, it was gold, it was cocoa, which was used to finance about 85% of the education programs throughout the country. And we all benefited. Now, as a result, I can tell you, much of Ashanti and Brong-Ahafo, the environment has been destroyed. There's such a dangerous development. The Sahara is even getting closer to Ashanti as a result of the uncontrolled farming activities over the years. So if you want to, I'm not being regionalistic, but then a price has been paid. Nobody is addressing that problem. But I'm not saying, therefore, that, of course, oil is a specialized industry. And we acknowledge that we must make provision today to meet the legitimate demands of the communities around the Cape Free points. No doubt about it. But as I'm saying, I think a lot would depend on the outcome of the discussions, the interactions that we hold together as civil society, as government, as parliament, and all that. I think the safeguards proposed should be strong enough to guarantee that the committee's interest will be safeguarded. So you're talking about stabilization and heritage. We inherited gold, diamonds, manganese, and all that. If we have now found oil, we should also leave something for the future. I am more concerned about what happens to the future, knowing that or recognizing that oil will become non-existent in about, 30 years' time, 40 years' time. So we've got to also provide for the future. Training of personnel, yes, you answered it. I believe that it is part of government policy to get investors to understand that part of the training, apart from sending them out, I mean, when you invest and hopefully you bring on technology on board, some of it will be left behind. Not everything will be carried away. So we believe that in that process, the training of the staff, of personnel, and all that, in addition, some technology will be transferred in the process of investment or investing. Disclosure of contracts. Again, this is a very sensitive area, especially for the investors. Some of them would not want to have everything that they agreed on with government or with their partners exposed. So it's a delicate balance between transparency and confidentiality. So, but to answer the question directly, that is not what is preventing the president from taking action on the demands that are being made. We ought to have a look, to study, and review whatever contracts that exist if we want to expose them to the general public. Because we don't also want to expose certain sensitive aspects of a contractual arrangement between, it's not just Ghana and the companies, but the companies and other interested investors. I hope you understand what I'm saying. If a company comes to invest and wants to transfer its assets to another company, do we insist that they should disclose that agreement? I don't know.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or two more questions, and then we have to close by 5 o'clock.
Yes, my name is Edward Hoyt with Nexent, an energy consultancy. I have a question about flare gas. The government has made a commitment to not have any flaring of associated gas on the oil fields. Obviously, that requires either reinjection or investment in the infrastructure necessary to bring the gas ashore, in addition to all of the other infrastructure, and to ensure that there is a market for that gas to use it productively. I'm wondering, first of all, if this is an issue that, from the civil society perspective, is something that you're tracking as well. Given the, I guess, 6 months now before first oil, what is the prospect for being able to honor that commitment? And then in a somewhat related question about the utilization of resources for investment in the thinking in the long term for investment in renewable energy assets and infrastructure for rural electrification, for power production in the future, to utilize this non-renewable resource in the near term in favor of the development of renewable resources in the long term. Thank you.
Question up front.
Hi, Patrick Heller from the Revenue Watch Institute. My question is about the scheduling of another piece of the legislative package, which is the structure of the Petroleum Regulatory Authority and the division of responsibilities among regulatory bodies and GNPC, the National Oil Company. I know that at a certain point, the previous government had submitted a bill to Parliament which envisioned a somewhat dramatic restructuring of how oil is supervised and regulated. And I'm just interested from Your Excellency whether there's any update on whether that bill is being revisited and or when there may be any proposals from the government. And if there is anything in the works, any hints you can give us about where the priorities might be structured would be much appreciated.
We'll take one more at the back.
Hello, my name is Kamina Edu, and I guess Mr. Adam may be best suited to answer this. I'm curious to know what criteria the government is using to demarcate the boundaries of the community around Cape Three Points.
Well, if it's a government issue, then you have to come to me. No, it's all right.
But you're in Washington, so I figured...
All right. He has all the information.
Okay, so who wants to go first? Ambassador?
I take one, he takes one. Then we have...
Okay.
Okay. I can start, Excellency.
This is the lightning round.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, zero flaring for gas. Yeah, I think that government has indicated that in its own policy, and we in civil society are also interested in that. Currently, the program of developing natural gas is in two forms, one for reinjection and the other for use in the production of electricity. In my presentation, I mentioned that two of the thermal plants, electricity thermal generating plants in Ghana, are in the western region, Efasu and Abuazi. They are combined cycles as well, and therefore they use both crude as well as gas. The gas component has been worked on, and so they are ready to receive gas. What we have noted is that government may not be able to utilize all the gas, nor will all the gas be reinjected. There will still be some flaring. And we have asked government to come clear on that. What they tell you is that we are going to use the gas to produce power. Part is going to be reinjected. But we have information to the effect that not all the gas will be utilized. And therefore, the companies may be forced, may be compelled to flare some. We all know the environmental effects of gas flaring. At the moment, government is conducting environmental impact assessment on the pipelines that are to be built between the field and the electricity generating plans, and we in civil society are monitoring the progress of the impact assessment. We have even called for it to be made public, and we have been told that as and when the draft is completed, to be made public. We are currently engaged in creating the awareness of our members, civil society organizations in the oil communities about the possibility of flaring gas. And they have to voice out their concerns together with the civil society platform. Until we have a clear policy on how the gas that will not be used, what is going to happen to it, we will continue to ensure that the production doesn't happen unless government uses force to do that. We will continue to engage parliament. We will continue to engage other stakeholders that can put pressure to be on government. So we're calling for a clear policy. So in terms of the development of the gas, we already have so much information about what is going to happen and what is not going to happen. And that has informed our position in calling for a clear policy on what will be done to the gas that will not be used.
Yeah, perhaps at this point, let me just tag in a little bit so that we conclude it. Well, as you said, there is a policy. We don't want all the gas to be flared up, obviously because of its impact on the environment. We all know. We've been talking about climate change. So it is important that that policy is taken seriously. Now, as to whether we can achieve that objective in totality is another question. But it's important that this remains a major focus. We have a policy to link up the gas pipeline that we will develop to the coast for power production. But we also have the West African gas pipeline. We want to tap into that one so that if we have the financing, when we talk about the gas, the utilization of gas, we're not talking about just Ghana alone. We have Ivory Coast. We have it's Cote d'Ivoire. We have Togo. We've been selling electricity to them for many years. We have Burkina Faso. We can even go beyond these other countries. To of course, Chad has now some oil, so we can go as far as Chad. But Niger and
that's
Mali.
That's another event.
So, you know, it's a huge demand. And therefore, when we talk about policy, we're not looking to Ghana. We're looking beyond Ghana. But, oil and gas as a policy, we think should serve as a catalyst for development in other areas. It's not just energy production, but we there are so many things we can do. Petrochemical industry development, it's there. It's a huge opportunity. We've been looking at the development of using the sea salt water. There are several opportunities. So energy is one. And there are other areas that we think we can use the oil and the gas to serve as catalyst for development.
Let me just touch a little bit on the regulatory issue that you raised. What government is trying to do, we in civil society are against. In terms of the regulatory regime, government wants to amend certain sections of existing laws to create a regulatory authority. Now, in creating the regulatory authority, the government is proposing that there is an existing institution we call the National Petroleum Authority, which currently regulates the downstream sector, pricing and standards. The amendments will be done so as to expand the mandate of the National Petroleum Authority to cover upstream as well. And therefore, a new regulatory bill is not going to be passed by the government. You see, we have concerns because the existing laws are not comprehensive enough, and they do not cover all the regulatory areas, especially those that relate to environment. You know, so we're saying that if you are just going to amend the section that says that the GMPC, which is the National Petroleum Company, will no longer do the regulation on behalf of the minister, and that is the amendment that is going to be done, you know, without touching on those that have to do with environment. Government could argue that we have environmental protection agency, but it's also within the ambit of a regulatory authority for a very complex industry like oil sector to have components of environmental regulation. You know, we think that if that will not be done, then we are not doing justice to the oil sector. And so we have called for a regulatory authority bill that will create an independent regulatory authority that will have powers to look at all environmental and other regulatory issues pertaining to the oil sector. One other issue regarding regulation is that the GNPC, which is currently doing the regulation on behalf of the minister, is having conflict of interest, you know, problems, because they have commercial interest. They are a participant, you know, in the current consortium of Jubilee Production. And how possible could somebody be a referee and a player at the same time? Now, when we raise these issues, government tells us that it is GMPC that has the capacity. And so if we are to take these regulatory powers from them or regulatory functions, they will say it is the minister who has the power to regulate. But indeed, it's the GMPC that is regulating, doing the regulation. So if we are to take the regulatory functions from GMPC and give it to another body, where will they have the capacity to do? And so we also ask government question, why then do you want to amend sections of the existing laws to expand the mandate of the National Petroleum Authority, because they don't have capacity, you know, to do the regulation, you know. So it is quite complex, and we want government to come straight on that. Create an independent authority, build their capacity. If GMPC has the capacity, poach the staff from GMPC or second them to the independent regulatory authority, and they can still play those functions. The indication that we have gotten as civil society is that government is planning to delay the passage of an independent regulatory law, which will create an independent regulatory authority, because they argue that who tells you that we don't have regulatory laws? That's what they will tell you. And our inside information indicates that this is going to be delayed for another 2 years, because we have existing so-called regulatory laws. But as I said earlier, these are not far-reaching enough, and we will want government to look at that. It is for this reason up till now, in spite of the fact that first oil is expected maybe in October, you know, this year, we haven't yet seen even the proposed amendments. They haven't been put in the public domain for the public to debate it. You know, so these are the very critical issues that we have raised regarding the issue of regulation. I don't know what Excellency will say about that, but I think it's very important that Ghana looks at that, because that is the core of oil production.
Yeah.
The oil curse, if we are to avoid it, then the regulation, I believe, is most important.
Yeah, and I'll give you the ambassador a quick final word.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. There's the need to address these challenges. But I'm also aware, and I'm sure you will be aware, that the Ministry of Justice and Attorney General has received several proposals and recommendations from several quarters to help the ministry and government